This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. It was a French gastronome who coined the now famous phrase, "We are what we eat." In her new book, Abigail Carroll adds to that idea that we are also how, when, and where we eat. She writes that our shared history explains a lot about American eating habits and provides answers to some very intriguing questions. Questions like, why are bacon and eggs or a bowl of cereal and juice considered breakfast? Why not a cheeseburger and fries in the morning? And why do we eat sandwiches for lunch? And why is supper the big meal of the day around which families traditionally gather? The answers tell us a lot about who we are and where we've come from. Among other things, they teach us that the idea of three square meals a day is a relatively recent social construct in America. We didn't always eat this way, so why do we now? Abigail Carroll is a writer and food historian who lives in Vermont. Her new book is Three Squares, The Invention of the American Meal, and she joins us now. Welcome to Radio Boston, Abigail Carroll. Really a great pleasure to have you.
Thanks for having me, Anthony.
Yeah, it's really a really fascinating book, and I want to invite listeners into this conversation. Listeners, what do you eat and why do you eat the way you do? That's the question. What does it say about where you come from and how do you see the American meal changing for better or for worse? Join the conversation. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. Abigail Carroll, we'll get into some of those intriguing questions that I mentioned at the top in a moment. But first, you write that this book about the American meal began with your intention to write about the American snack. So tell us a bit about how this book came to be.
That's right. I was doing research for the Indiana State Museum for an exhibition, and I was specifically researching the correlation between obesity and snacking. And since obesity is a relatively recent phenomenon, I thought, well, I wonder how long snacking has been around. Hmm. And I realized very quickly as I started to look into that question that there just aren't any books that look in depth at the history of snacking in American culture. And so I set out to write one. But as I plunged into my research, it didn't take me long to realize that the story of the snack is really the story also of the meal, that you can't really tell one without telling both.
Hmm. And you write really interestingly about sort of where the snack and the meal sort of intersect, and we'll get to that. But I want to ask you a little bit about some of the, because so much of what you write about leads to some really interesting history. You write that your investigative journey began, as many do, with the simple question of why. And so let me just ask a couple of those questions about why. For example, let's talk about the American breakfast. Why is it limited to the things that we associate with breakfast? Eggs and bacon, or maybe
sure.
toast and a bowl of cereal, some
sure.
juice, rather than, say, a bowl of salad and some French fries.
Great question. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it wasn't always that way. Historically, there weren't such things as quote-unquote breakfast foods. There really wasn't a strong demarcation between the various meals. So for breakfast, you might have leftovers from the previous day's dinner. And if you didn't have that, you might just have some cornmeal mush. If you had cornmeal mush for supper the previous evening, you might reheat that as Johnny cakes the next morning. And then as breakfast grew, as people prospered, as there was more meat available in the 1700s and especially in the 1800s, breakfast looked a lot like dinner. There was a lot of meat, just a variety of starches. And because of the Industrial Revolution and because Americans were starting to move towards cities and were embracing a more urban and sedentary lifestyle, they were suffering from a rather national case of indigestion. They called it dyspepsia. And the modern breakfast really comes out of that, especially the light sort of grain-based breakfast. Breakfast cereal comes out of the sanitariums during that era, most famously the one that was run by William Keith Kellogg. And it was basically a panacea for all health problems, in particular dyspepsia. And it became associated with milk, and orange juice comes into the story when vitamins are discovered, and milk at first is seen as a sort of miracle food in an era when people were really concerned about deficiency diseases. And orange juice then comes in as another miracle food.
Really interesting. So rather than sort of people are making these choices because it's what they like, you make the point that seems to be one of the biggest influences on the way we eat is the way we work.
That's right. And that was one of the things that surprised me most in my research. I knew that dinner was really shaped by work because dinner used to be in the middle of the day, and that's what had suited an agrarian society. But it shifted to the evening during the Industrial Revolution to accommodate the fact that people who were in cities were living farther from home, and it wasn't feasible for them to go home in the middle of the day for a hot meal. And it also wasn't feasible to have a large hot meal and then return to a desk and sort of work at a desk for the rest of the day. So dinner, I had always known, really was shaped by work. But it turns out that lunch, which comes in to fill the vacuum that's left behind when dinner, you know, leaves the middle of the day, is all about work. And then breakfast, too, becomes tailored to become this much smaller meal so that it's basically efficient. It's efficient to make, it's efficient to eat, and it doesn't leave us, you know, with such a heaviness that we can't be efficient in our work.
Mm. And lunch, sort of the same thing, right? I mean, the idea of stuff that's quick to grab, a sandwich, easy to make, easy mm-hmm. to carry, easy to transport, for the middle of the day and to eat in a workplace as well, right?
Sure, yeah. I sort of characterize as a lunch as cold, cheap, and quick. Of course, it wasn't always all three of those, but, you know, lunch became defined by the circumstance more than notions about taste or health or other things, although those things eventually, you know, always have some sort of influence. Mm.
Well, let's talk about, I want to talk with you more about dinner, because when it comes to that big sort of traditional family meal at the end of the day, you point to statistics that show that there's dwindling participation in this convention, right?
Sure. The family dinner, as we know it and as we think of it, at least as an ideal, it comes out of the Victorian era and really had its zenith, I'd say, in the 1950s, and has been in a state of decline since the 1950s. People are not eating together around a table with their families as much as they used to. There are more distractions, such as, you know, televisions and other screens. And, you know, there's, I think people, when I talk to people about the fact that I'm writing or that I've just written a book about the meal, they're very quick to tell me that they often, you know, feel guilty about not having family dinners, and that perhaps they try, but they sort of can't seem to make it happen. And, you know, I don't solicit that guilt, but it comes. Mm-hmm. And I think that's because there is a lot of value in the meal, even if it is an invented cultural phenomenon. It's something that we derive a lot of benefit from. You know, children who grow up in households where they're eating together regularly, they take in more nutritious foods. You know, they have lower intake of sodium and sugar and saturated fats. And they also, on average, get higher grades in school, do better on test scores. They're less likely to develop eating disorders, less likely to abuse drugs and alcohol. So there's a lot of correlations with family meals and, you know, other health benefits and social benefits.
And this is where your study, your sort of original study of the snack sort of intersects with the American meal, because at the same time that we're finding dwindling participation in the family meal, we're seeing a big rise in snack consumption, and probably not coincidentally, big problems with obesity rates, right?
Yes, yes. You know, there was a snacking explosion, if you will, during the 1980s. In the 1970s, if you walked down a snack food aisle in a grocery store, there would be about 250 new snack food products on that aisle every year. But in the early 80s, that leapt to 1,000, and by the end of the 1980s, it was 2,000, and I'm not sure where it is now, but certainly it was in the same decade that we saw a leap, really, in obesity rates as well, and just overweight in general.
Mm. So a good case there to try to preserve the family meal, it would seem to be.
I think so.
Yeah. Do you really feel it's under threat?
Well, I don't think it's under a conscientious threat,
right.
But I think that we value work in our society a lot. We are quite an overworked society. We work more hours than any other Western or industrialized nation. And, you know, we tailor our eating to accommodate that. And business is having, you know, a great boon in helping us accommodate that. You know, they're always coming up with new foods and new ways of eating and new ways of serving. You know, fast food has certainly benefited from this. And yeah, so I think that it's not a conscious threat, but if we want to sort of revive a tradition of eating together, I think we will have to do so very consciously and very intentionally.
Listeners, we're talking to Abigail Carroll. She's the author of Three Squares, The Invention of the American Meal. The question to you is, why do you eat the way you do? What does it say about where you come from? And how do you see the American meal changing, either for better or for worse? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And Abby, we've got some listeners who'd love to get in on this conversation. So let's go to at least a couple of them right now. Keith is calling from Douglas, Massachusetts. Hi, Keith. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, Abigail. It's an interesting subject. Very interesting. And so I called right away. When I was right out of college, I had the good fortune to, my roommate, his mother was Korean. And we managed to take a trip together where I went to Seoul, and I spent 3 weeks in Seoul. And I had the good fortune to have, you know, breakfast, lunch, and dinner to stay in their home and their family. And what I found so interesting, and this is sort of off with what someone had mentioned earlier on your show, you said we are what we eat. And we eat where we're from. And it made me realize in the morning, well, we'd have a hearty meal in the evening. It would be always with rice, always with kimchi. And for breakfast the very next day, it would be the very same dishes. It would be just leftover. And I just wonder, I mean, there was no cereal, no orange juice, no typical bacon, and, you know, but it was just more of the same. In fact, it was the very same dishes. And they would just repeat it, kimchi and vegetable dishes. I'm just wondering, you know, how does that make what we are? How or where did we all start with this orange juice and cereals and
yeah? But Keith, Abby explained some of that. But your point raises a really interesting question. I mean, Abby, do we know if what Keith is describing is the way it used to be here, right?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. In fact, there's a time when European travelers in the 1800s were remarking in their journals and their travelogues that, you know, there was no difference between dinner and breakfast in the United States, except that wine was served at one and not at the other.
Really interesting. Keith, thanks so much for the call. Let's go to Lee, who's calling from Gardner, Massachusetts. Hi, Lee, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I do travel quite a bit. I go overseas quite often, and what I've found is the whole menu is so different that I embrace the differences, and I find that deli meats, cheeses, breads in the morning, rather than your typical bacon, eggs, and whatever, sets me up for a better day. And I have a good, hearty meal that most people would either do in the afternoon or the evening. And then we have a good, nice, light lunch with a salad or whatever. And then for dinner, it's fruit, veggies, whatever. And then I come back to the U.S. and I slump back into the same old crap that I eat all the time. And I feel much better when I'm traveling overseas. And I've changed my lifestyle. And you know, it's not what we eat, it's where we are and who we are.
All right, Lee, thank you so much for the call. Abigail, I'm wondering what you heard in Lee's description of what he eats overseas versus what he eats here.
Sure. Well, one thing that makes me think of is this idea of, you know, the notions of health and whether we should eat a big breakfast or a light breakfast, a big dinner or a light dinner. And, you know, those arguments are nothing new. They've been taking place for a long time. Should we graze? Should we eat regular set meals? And if so, how many? You know, when the colonists first came to North America, they encountered Native Americans who were more or less grazing. And, of course, the colonists were appalled because for them that was evidence that there was a lack of civilization. But for the Native Americans, that was completely natural. And it also reminds me of the story of bacon and eggs, which was kind of a pushback to that light breakfast that everyone thought was so healthy, you know, to have just that, you know, piece of toast and, you know, coffee and orange juice and or some cereal and milk. And, you know, the Beech Nut Company, which was a packing company, had a lot of bacon that they wanted to sell, and they were looking for new ways to sell it. And so they found a publicist who was willing to do a little bit of investigation with some doctors and get quite a few doctors to advocate for a heavy breakfast. And they pushed the idea of bacon and eggs. And that was very much an invented tradition of the 1920s.
And was that a belief in protein, protein, protein? Because for a while, that was you know, one of the mantras about how to eat healthfully. I remember my father telling me when I was very young that when us kids came along, that was sort of what my parents were sort of led to believe they had to sort of pump us full of, protein, protein, protein.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that, again, that goes sort of this up and down wave depending on what's being discovered or what's in the news. So, you know, when milk is sort of discovered to be this miracle food, everyone's drinking a lot of it, but they don't know how much they need to get the vitamin A that's required to sort of, you know, not get the various deficiency diseases associated with lack of vitamin A. So, yeah, and then there were moments, you know, caffeine was the fad. There were other moments when mastication was the fad. That was to chew and chew and chew and spend numerous minutes with each mouthful. So,
Abby, I'm struck by what seems to be, I don't know, I'd almost call it schizophrenia about eating in America right now. I mean, on the one hand, there's this risk in snacking, as you suggest. Obesity rates are way up, and it's the age of the supersized burger and fries and the big gulp. On the other hand, there's this food culture, cooking shows, Top Chef, all of that locally sourced stuff, endless writing about sort of wonderful foods and how to get good foods. We seem to be obsessed with foods, but I'm wondering if the obsession is taking us in the right direction. What do you think?
Well, it is quite a paradox. And I just think that it shows that we've been just bombarded with messages for a long time. And we've also, you know, made strong connections between food and morality, such as during the Victorian era when snacking became taboo and you weren't supposed to eat it. But you also weren't supposed to eat it because it was unhealthy. And there's, you know, the Victorian era, which I do believe very much influences our era, even though it was 150 years ago. The Victorian era was just all about do's and don'ts. It was all about control. It was all about restraint. And, you know, at a formal dinner table, you had to follow all those rules of etiquette. And if you didn't, you betrayed yourself as perhaps not middle class, but somebody who was sort of performing as or trying to get away as, you know, a proper person. And and people were afraid, you know, that sugar would lead to alcoholism. And so, you know, you had to, you know, really rein in that sweet tooth. So there's all of these do's and don'ts and all of these connections with morality. And I think that, you know, we've inherited that, but there's sort of less and less clarity, I think, and consensus, especially lasting clarity or lasting consensus.
You know, speaking of those do's and don'ts, you have some really nice examples in this book. Early promotional materials from Quaker Oats would say, tire not the digestion, and that it would promote strong bones and teeth. Then there were early claims of advocates for school lunch that a cold lunch diverted blood to the stomach and away from the brain. Hot food, it was thought, stimulated digestive juices, right? And inhibited by cold food. So there was all kinds of, I mean, over time, there've been all kinds of do's and don'ts and not necessarily well-founded advice, it sounds like.
Well, based on, you know, all sorts of notions, sometimes science and sometimes not.
You know, early in the book, there are wonderful descriptions about the way folks used to eat in this country. You include in sort of some of the history, a wonderful passage about the observations of a Dr. Alexander Hamilton, and that's not the Hamilton who was Secretary of the Treasury, but a travel writer, right? Mm-hmm. And describe what he encounters in 1744 on a journey from Maryland to Maine.
So he's about to cross the Susquehanna River, and the ferry boatman is in his house eating dinner with his family. And so Dr. Hamilton goes into the house, and the family invites him to sit down, and they are eating fish without utensils. They're eating it with their hands, and it's a very homely meal. And you know, in this time period, and especially before then, people often ate with their hands. They used bread to sop juices and sort of in a spoon-like fashion. They might have a knife, and if they did, that would be used to cut the food, as well as in a fork-like fashion to transport it to their mouths. Forks didn't really come on the scene until the 1700s, and they appeared with two tines at first. And, you know, tables, even tables and chairs, were relatively rare in the first decades of European settlement. And so people would sit on wooden crates or stools. Sometimes they just squatted or leaned against a wall. And, you know, people often sat, interestingly, on one side of a table, or if they didn't have a table, they would put a trestle board between onto trestles. And they often sat on one side of it. They did not emphasize socializing at meals. They didn't talk a lot. In fact, European travelers have always commented that Americans eat in silence and in haste. So it's very rustic eating.
Do you think in general our bodies, our sort of physical constitutions are coping with the evolution of the American meal?
I'm not sure I'm the one to answer that question. Well, you know, I think that I certainly didn't really make any value judgments in terms of, you know, the nutrition and whatnot. But I would say I think we have certainly lost a lot with processed food and prepared foods. I guess this is what sort of concerns me, and that is that prepared foods we now spend half of our food dollars on. They represent a very significant portion of our caloric intake, and they are almost always, by definition, higher in salt, sugar, and fat. We also eat more of them. You know, when we're presented with food at a restaurant or snack food, you know, these foods are designed to court the neurons in our brains that love flavor and taste, and especially that love those taste factors of salt, sugar, and fat. And when we eat in front of screens, which we tend to, you know, eat processed food in front of screens, our bodies forget to tell us when we've had enough. Yeah.
It's just sort of a habit of just reaching into that pot of yummy, salty sweetness or whatever it is, as long as the screen keeps flickering in front of our eyes.
That's right. Yes.
Well, Abigail Carroll, it's been a real pleasure. She's the author of Three Squares, The Invention of the American Meal. You can read an excerpt at radioboston.org. Abigail Carroll, thank you so much. So grateful. So good to have you.
Thank you, Anthony.
And listeners, stay with us. Coming up, Club Delft brings their Moroccan-infused jazz trance music live to our studio. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.